Great question. The Manufacturing Podcast offers news and information for the people who make, store, and move things, and those who manage and maintain the facilities where that work gets done.
Please enjoy the audio from this live stream recorded on April 25th. Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to Production Pulse, typically our bi-weekly video series here at Industry Week to talk about important news in the manufacturing world. This week it's turning to be weekly because we're adding a bonus episode to talk about regulations. It's been a very active April. Maybe it's because of Earth Day and Earth Month and Earth Week, but for whatever reason, the EPA has really chosen this week to throw in a lot of consequential rulings, and so I thought we'd talk about that with a group of experts here. Going around the table, we have John Katz, who is with Chemical Processing, one of our publications within Endeavor Business Media. Next to him, we have Lynn Bergeson, who is an attorney. I'm sorry, Lynn, if you could go ahead and say the name of the firm.
I'm with Bergeson and Campbell in Washington, D.C.
Right. And Inland's also a regular contributor to Chemical Processing and a real expert on a lot of these regulatory issues. We have Andy Hanicek with Food Processing and Bob Crossan with Water World, all of our publications dealing with various issues in this chemicals world. So thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
So thank you. I wanted to start with you, John, and what's going on with the big chemical plant ruling. So back on April 9th, beginning of the month, the EPA had a fairly significant ruling on toxic emissions from several different products. I was hoping you could walk us through what the ruling was and what the impact is on various chemical producers.
Sure. So the ruling, it's an emissions monitoring ruling that will impact, I think, about 200 chemical plants. Many of them are along the Gulf Coast, Louisiana, and Texas. And these plants produce synthetic organic chemicals and various polymers and resins. The ruling pertains to six specific chemicals, ethylene oxide, chloroprene, benzene, 1,3-butadiene, ethylene dichloride, and vinyl chloride. And it specifically targets fence line monitoring. That's monitoring around the perimeter of a facility. I believe that the monitoring must begin within 2 years of the effective date for all the chemicals except for chloroprene, which is 90 days. And to meet these requirements, plants are going to need to take various corrective actions, including improvements to equipment like heat exchangers, and improve the efficiency of various processes such as flaring and venting. I believe the EPA estimated the total cost at about $1.8 billion for chemical plants to implement some of these measures. So it's definitely going to have a big impact on the industry. And I don't know, Lynn, if you had any further insight into the potential impact for chemical producers that you wanted to add.
Sure, John, thank you. You did a great job summarizing this important rule that we in the industry call the HON-NESHAP, Hazardous Organic NESHAP. In addition to enhanced compliance costs, derivative of diminished standards under fugitive and point source emissions, you're looking at just the type of cost you will need to retrofit your facility to meet those standards. The other thing that I'm looking for is, given the location of many of the directly impacted manufacturing facilities, any type of air emission and fence line monitoring has to be looked at in a broader context of environmental justice concerns, to the extent that any of these manufacturing facilities are located in marginalized communities. EPA's current administration, very focused review of environmental justice impacts, could have not just Clean Air Act compliance issues in meeting these new standards and the cost of enhanced monitoring, fence line monitoring, and other costs. You're also going to be looking at third party litigation concerns, to the extent that any of these facilities are emitting these HANs, these hazardous organic pollutants, at concentrations that are believed to pose unique impacts on susceptible subpopulations. So I'd be looking at that too. I'd be looking at enhanced enforcement opportunities for EPA and for third-party NGOs and other private parties that are looking to ratchet down emissions even more. The other impact I'd be looking at is ethylene oxide. As you noted, John, was one of the parameters that is specifically listed in the HON. Ethylene oxide has been the subject of intense global review because of its perceived carcinogenicity issues. So to the extent that ethylene oxide producers and users in the sterilization community and the healthcare community can also be expected to endure more scrutiny, more review, and more derivative third-party litigation.
Right. Thank you both for that. It's obviously a significant ruling that we're going to have to keep an eye on for years to come here. But it was not the only significant ruling. That was April 9th, April 19th, last week. We had the big expected ruling. This has been in the works for a long time on the PFAS chemicals. And I'm going to turn this over to Bob Crossan because this really affects the water industry significantly. And Bob, can you tell us a little about what PFAS are and what this April 19th ruling really says?
Yeah, so PFAS are per and polyfluorinated alkyl substances. So it's a family of chemicals. There's thousands of these, but the focus has primarily been for this April 19th thing on two of them. Those are perfluorooctanoic acid, PFOA, and perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, also known as PFOS. These have been the two core ones. Under this new ruling, it fits under CERCLA. So that is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, and it lists them as hazardous substances. What this essentially allows is for EPA to take legal recourse and enforcement actions against agencies who are basically creating contamination in their eyes under this rule. So it directly impacts really more of the manufacturers, but it has this knock-on effect for water utilities and wastewater utilities around the country because they also receive these chemicals in their streams, both in drinking water plants and wastewater plants. Now, we are talking about this April 19th thing, but it also is the second ruling in the water sector since the beginning of this month. On April 10th, we had the maximum contaminant level rule, which included those two PFAS chemicals that are now officially regulated by the US EPA. Compliance is 5 years from now, so utilities are focused on that. But the main thing that we're hearing from utilities on the CERCLA side of things, on this cleanup side, is that they do not want to be held liable for having PFAS in their streams when they're simply receiving it. There was an enforcement discretion that was also issued with this ruling that EPA basically said, look, we're going after the manufacturers of these chemicals. We're not planning to target water utilities. We're not planning to target fire departments or airports where AFFF foam, which has PFAS in it, has been used in trainings and firefighting efforts. So the one thing that a lot of these utilities and these experts in the water industry are concerned about is that liability aspect. That enforcement discretion helps, but it doesn't shield them from everything. And it definitely doesn't shield them from third-party lawsuits. That is to say, if an environmental group were to notice PFAS in their drinking water or their wastewater streams, they could then still sue those facilities with this enforcement action being in place.
And Andy, I mean, this is what we're talking about April here, but even earlier this year, there was some action on food packaging involving these chemicals. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. In February, actually, it wasn't so much I read it more as almost a celebratory announcement by the FDA more than a regulation. They effectively announced that they've ended sales of certain grease proofing agents that are used in packaging that contain PFAS. And they made it known in the announcement that they'd gone to a lot of the manufacturers prior to this and sort of voluntarily asked them to remove it, and the manufacturers said they could. It would take X amount of time, and it actually happened more quickly than expected. So, you know, kind of a hooray, yay, big win for the food industry. What that means, those greaseproofing agents, they're used in different types of packaging to basically, in effect, waterproof and greaseproof the packaging so that the food stuffs that are in them don't waterlog or oil log or grease log the package, and then you just have a mess. It's basically used for, you know, the always embattled microwave popcorn bags that everybody always is worried about. And yeah, as you can see, we've got a picture of all the wonderfulness inside of the bag after you dump the popcorn out. Took some interesting searches on stock sites to find that, but also used in fast food wrappers, which is probably why you know, if you eat while you drive, you get ketchup down your shirt. It's because the packaging didn't absorb it. So big win in terms of those who want PFAS out of the packaging. Big accomplishment for the industry as well. But probably, you know, just my own personal opinion, there's a lot more work to do. And this might have been in some ways a lower hanging fruit in a sense. I'm not diminishing what they've done. There's PFAS, you know, concerns in all types of food products and beverage products. I know FDA has been sampling products for years, and they're finding a lot of it in seafood, you know, where the plastics are migrating into the seafood, into the animal, fish, whatever you want to call it, crustaceans, and then making their way into the food supply that way. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that's all regulated, how that's eliminated. You know, the food industry has faced over the last several months a lot of take this out kind of regulation. And PFAS seems to be one that might not be as simple as something like food additives and things like that. But we shall see. I mean, the food industry has faced a lot of challenges similar to this and overcome them in the past. It'll be very interesting to see how we move forward.
Lynn, your take on this. I mean, we were talking earlier about how widespread this action has been.
Sure. Well, a couple of things. I wanted to circle back, Robert, to your introductory remark. Why are we seeing all of this tsunami of federal regulatory action? It is driven in part to both celebrate Earth Day, which, of course, we just celebrated on Monday, but also to avoid congressional reversal of regulatory initiatives after a certain period of time when Congress adjourns. As many of our listeners and participants appreciate, the Congressional Review Act has been used pretty robustly in prior years to undo regulatory actions that occurred within the zone of the jurisdictional reach of the Congressional Review Act. So EPA is working very hard to wind that down, some of the rules that it began working on years ago, to get them out before the Congressional Review Act can undo them if there is another administration, given the elections coming up in November. So that's one explanation for what we will see over the next month, is just a tsunami of regulations. I have a slightly different view of the listing under 103 of CERCLA of PFOA and PFOS. I mean, it was inevitable. It came as a surprise to no one that EPA has identified these two very prominent C8, you know, a longer chain PFAS, which are perceived to be much more toxic than PTFE and other fluoropolymers, as hazardous substances. It authorizes the federal government to identify entities to clean up contamination that compromises human health and the environment. And I applaud EPA for issuing its enforcement discretion document, but many of our clients would have been much happier if the categories that Bob carefully went through, water systems, storm sewer systems, POTWs, solid waste landfills, publicly owned airports, and farms where biosolids have been applied, it would have been a much more comfortable position to have them immunized entirely from CERCLA cleanup responsibility. And enforcement discretion is not a law. It is not a rule. It is a guidance document. And I think EPA intends to try to protect passive recipients of these very pervasive PFAS substances, but that will not necessarily immunize those entities from third-party liability, NGO liability, or other forms of exposure. So a lot of people in my community, in the private sector, are kind of bracing themselves for just a lot of Superfund cleanup liability, third-party liability, and other forms of liability that are derivative of EPA's identification of PFOS and PFOA as hazardous substance under CERCLA. It will also have derivative implications for corrective action requirements under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. I don't mean to knock EPA. I think it was inevitable the rule was going to come out, but it will open up a lot of closed Superfund sites to reopener provisions to clean up historic legacy contamination of PFOS and PFOA. One final point, gentlemen, as you know, both of these substances are no longer largely in commercial use. They were phased out by 3M back in 2002, and more recently under the EPA program, the PFOA stewardship program, that pretty much knocked these substances out by 2015. So they're not currently largely in use. So we will expect to find historic contamination in the ground, in the water, and in sediment in actions throughout the country, which I think is going to inspire a whole lot of private litigation and EPA cleanup actions under CERCLA.
Yeah, you mentioned the timing of this with the regulatory changeover is you go back a few years when the Obama administration was on its way out, it tried to rush through, say, like the fuel efficiency mandates and did not leave themselves enough time to really get those finalized before the Trump administration came in and was able to reverse a lot of those. So it sounds like the Biden administration maybe learned some lessons from that and is trying to get the everything sealed before any change happens.
It is. I hear it actively mentioned by my colleagues at EPA. It's like, we have to get these things out or we are in harm's way because of the Congressional Review Act, which will undo the hard work that this administration has been spending a lot of energy perfecting, implementing its PFOA stewardship program.
So, John, moving forward from here, I mean, what are you hearing from the chemical companies themselves? You know, when it comes to their liability for cleanups and things like this? John, we don't have audio on you for a second here, so let's.
Oh, sorry about that. I muted myself. I haven't heard too much from the chemical manufacturers regarding this particular. Ruling, I imagine that they're going to be, looking for ways to, and again, Lynn, you might have some more insight into this as far as substituting chemicals in their formulations. I don't know exactly what they're looking at to correct that issue, but I imagine it's going to be something they'll be discussing a lot in the coming year.
The two contaminants that are relevant here, as I noted a minute ago, are largely no longer in commercial use. I would say upwards of 99% of the PFOA and PFOS that had been very popular for decades prior to the 2002 timeframe are no longer in use. They're not being produced. And those that are in use are low volume, low release applications. It is the contamination element that I find somewhat disturbing. We can expect, for example, large swaths of U.S. farmlands to have applied biosolids containing these contaminants on the property, rise to ground contamination and groundwater contamination.
Bob, you had a hand up there for a second.
Yeah, I wanted to build on what she was talking about, the biosolids thing, because there is this element that is being discussed right now with EPA. They're trying to identify that and solve it as a problem. And it directly impacts the wastewater facilities that are out there, because through the wastewater process, you're obviously treating a liquid waste flow, but it results in a solid at the end as well, which are called biosolids. And there are a lot of states out there and a lot of use cases out there where those are, that those biosolids are called beneficial reuse.
Activity issue there for a second.
Well, I'm building on the biosolids thing and talking about it within the realm of wastewater treatment, because there is this biosolid that happens at the end of those treatment processes, and it's a natural part of that whole thing. The water is discharged, if meets certain discharge limits, gets discharged into a local waterway, and then those solids, oftentimes there's three specific ways that utilities deal with it. They landfill it, so they bring it to a landfill, they can incinerate it, or they can do what they call beneficial reuse, which often is land application. So in what Lynn was talking about is taking those biosolids, applying them to farmland as fertilizer, and that's the beneficial reuse there. The concern is that PFAS might be found in those biosolids. EPA currently is working on a risk assessment of that, which is supposed to be released later this year. I've heard December, but you know, timeframes can change. So we don't have exact specific data on that right now from EPA, but they are working on it. But that has not stopped certain states from addressing PFAS and biosolids. For example, Maine is probably the most well-known for this, where it has banned land application entirely, and then that has turned into the landfills are now having to accept it when they weren't before, but now they don't want to be held liable for the PFAS contamination. So they're refusing to accept it. And it's turning into this whole biosolids problem of where does it go? And my understanding at this moment in time is that it's oftentimes going over the border into Canada, into landfills up in to our neighbor to the north. So there were similar bans that were in place. I believe one of them was in Arizona. There was another state that I cannot recall off the top of my head, so I'm not going to list it. But those have since been rescinded. The main one is still in place, from my understanding.
That is such a good point, Bob, because there's so much quantity of this material that historically has been applied for fertilization on farmlands that it's like you squeeze a balloon, you fix one problem and you invite the generation of another. So that is definitely a concern on what to do with this material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big question I think a lot of water utilities are in right now. We have the chemical manufacturers who are dealing with this, but the water utilities who are passively receiving it, they're treating it with the common technologies there are granular activated carbon, ion exchange, and reverse osmosis. With carbon and with ion exchange, it's either a carbon media or a resin media for filtration. You end up with a PFAS-laden media that you now have to dispose of that. And the concentration is much higher in that because that's the intention of it. So there have been a lot of questions on how do we dispose? How do we destroy? EPA did release, I believe, within the past month, some guidance documentation on that, updating their rules on what they believe is acceptable and not or not. Deep well injection is listed in there, and incineration is also listed in there. I think there were a couple of others, but I don't, again, can't recall them off the top of my head. But those seem to be the two that folks are looking at. But again, it's creating this question of like, all right, if we incinerate it, now is it part of this air problem for this regulation we just talked about? If we deep well inject it, does it create a problem for future generations who now have PFAS deeply injected into the ground? And is that going to create other issues? So the question is like, how far are we kicking this can down the road and where does the buck stop?
Well stated.
We'll obviously be keeping an eye on this from a lot of different directions. So thank you everyone for joining us today. It's a fascinating conversation. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about later in the year or in the years to come as we watch for the impacts of this. Thank you all for joining us today. Thank you to Lynn Bergeson, Andy Hanicek, John Katz, and Bob Crossan for joining us today on Production Pulse. Have a great afternoon.